they have to learn to do that in a private space.
Right.
You know, so in their room or the bathroom with the door shut and locked. But if they're doing that publicly, then that's definitely going to be a maladaptive behavior.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another Family Care Learning Podcast. My name is Brandon Jones, and with me I have Jenny Dalcor, a clinical services supervisor. And for those listening or watching, I just want to give a quick heads up that the topic that we have on the agenda today is something that's a little bit mature. So if you have little ones that are kind of listening in, you might want to wait until those ears are out of the room for this one. So the topic is sexually maladaptive behaviors, or otherwise we call SMB. And this is something I just, it's again, just another kind of growing, trending issue that we're seeing more and more as we serve clients. Yeah. And so Jenny, will you talk a little bit about what is sexually maladaptive behavior?
Sure. The term sexually maladaptive behavior is really an umbrella term.
Okay.
And it holds a couple different varieties of those behaviors. We have, first of all, we have sexually reactive behaviors. Okay. And sexually reactive behaviors are behaviors that are sexual in nature, but that are really a reflection or a reenactment of the child's past trauma.
Okay.
So when you have a child who's gone through abuse,
yeah,
and generally sexual abuse, but sometimes neglect or physical abuse as well, then they're reenacting elements of this trauma. Sometimes it's helpful to think about it almost like it can be like a flashback in a way, of the past trauma. So they're reenacting it.
Yeah.
They're acting out of the dysregulation of their trauma. Or it's a behavior that they were specifically taught to do within their trauma.
Yeah.
And so now they may not understand that, no, that behavior isn't okay.
Yeah.
You know, when they were taught by a trusted grown-up to do that behavior, they continue to do that behavior, not understanding.
Okay.
So that's one part of it.
Okay.
The other part is sexually aggressive behavior. And that's also under this umbrella group of sexually maladaptive or, you know, unhealthy behaviors. And that's when you think of perpetrators.
Oh,
when you think of aggressive sexual behaviors. So I won't label a child or a teenager as a perpetrator
because
that's shaming and it's not really accurate and it doesn't reflect the child's potential for growth and change as a child. They're still children.
Yeah.
But we will call that, you know, sexually aggressive behavior.
Okay.
Those behaviors may have started as sexually reactive behavior. You know, those kids may have also experienced abuse and likely experienced abuse and or neglect in their past.
Yeah.
But these behaviors take it a step further. It's not a knee-jerk kind of reaction.
Okay.
It's not to a trigger, to a trauma trigger. It's generally, it's premeditated. They're planned behaviors.
Yeah.
And it often will involve grooming the other person, usually a younger child. Some grooming. They'll prepare, slowly acclimate the younger child to this sexualized behavior.
Yeah.
And it can be with threats of violence or threats of any kind of coercion. Sometimes it does involve physical violence as well as the sexual aggressive behavior.
Yeah.
So it is definitely a different category than just the knee-jerk sexually reactive behaviors. And that's usually what we see in children and teenagers as well, is the sexually reactive behavior, not the aggressive behavior.
Okay. And so thinking about kind of that, right, like there's this wide variety of different kind of behaviors. What you mentioned, like trauma, is trauma always the thing that causes like sexually reactive behaviors, or what causes sexually reactive behaviors?
Generally that's the reason.
Yeah.
Generally that they're reenacting their past trauma.
Yeah.
Usually sexual abuse. And sometimes it's not what we think of as sexual abuse, but it's more exposure.
Okay.
So I think now with the prevalence of pornography, you know, I mean, it's on cell phones, it's on kids' tablets, it's on their school, laptops that they use, their Chromebooks that they use in school, they're able to access a lot of pornography.
Yeah.
And in homes, it's just so prevalent in the society we're in. And so being exposed to adult sexuality.
Yeah.
Can also then teach this child to do those behaviors or give those behaviors a try. Yeah. And that can be, again, sexually reactive behavior. They're just acting out what they saw on a computer screen. Mm. So sometimes people don't think about that so much.
Yeah.
Or even just exposure to inappropriate sexuality in the home, whether that's between mom and dad or between other children in the home.
Yeah.
If they've had actual abuse. And also there's another category that's definitely less of what we see, especially here at Christian Family Care, but we also have kids with developmental disabilities.
Ooh, yeah.
Who have these adult looking bodies. They may be 15, 16 year olds with, sexually mature bodies, but they are developmentally closer to 2 or 3 years old or, somewhere around there. And so what's developmentally appropriate for a 2 year old to be curious about people's bodies, what do bodies look like? Right. You've got a 2 year old who likes to peek underneath the stalls at a public restroom, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's developmentally appropriate.
Don't do that.
We teach the child. No. That's a private place. But you may have a child with a developmental disorder or disability where they don't understand.
Mm.
And they just also have to be taught. But it's not necessarily because they've experienced trauma. And it's definitely not because they're having any kind of sexually aggressive behavior.
Yeah.
They just don't know. And what they're doing is developmentally appropriate if you consider their true developmental age.
Mm, that is such an important piece, right? So in many ways, right? Like what we think of as like normal curiosity or something that has sparked their interest because of to your point, like even commercials nowadays are like highly sexualized. And so it's like something that could be almost as benign as a commercial while you're watching Sunday football games or something could be influencing something where a child is curious. And so I think sometimes in parents, they're at least I know, right, as a parent, where it's like, is this bad? What is this? Yeah. Right. Like, and so when I'm as a parent and I'm looking at my child and my child's doing something that is alarming to me, how do you know if it's like sexually maladaptive or just like normal development?
Yeah, because it is normal for kids to be little, especially young children, to be curious about their bodies, to be curious about other people's bodies.
Yeah.
They just don't know. Do you have what I have?
Right.
They don't know. And to even, touch themselves, or you think of like a 2 year old who gets undressed in public. Takes off their shirt in the middle of a family dinner, like, right?
No, don't do that.
And that's a great opportunity to teach boundaries, and that's fine. That's fine. This is not a child we're worried that they're going to become a sexual deviant in the future, right? So look at that. Look at the age of your child. Okay. So part of it is just that. Is it curiosity? They're just curious.
Yeah.
They don't know.
Yeah.
They're asking the questions. Is that what this is? If that's the case, answer the questions.
Yeah.
Please answer the questions. You don't want your child to go on the internet or to go to their friends to look for the answers, because they're going to keep looking for the answers.
Yeah.
That's normal to be curious.
Yeah.
But we want to be the ones that answer the questions as their parent. So, look at that. Then you look at, this is not just normal curiosity. If you see a child who's doing something beyond normal curiosity, if it's beyond what's developmentally appropriate for their age, if you have a 16-year-old who's looking under the stalls in public restrooms,
right,
and they don't have a developmental disability, well, that's very different than a 2-year-old.
Right.
So we're looking at that. We're looking where there are other people involved with the sexual behavior.
Okay.
Even things like masturbation is not generally outside of developmental, appropriateness. They have to learn to do that in a private space.
Right.
So in their room or the bathroom with the door shut and locked. But if they're doing that publicly, then that's definitely going to be a maladaptive behavior.
Yeah.
So we're looking at that. If they're doing these activities with other children, that can sometimes be just curiosity. When you have two 6-year-olds together going, what do you have? I have this. That's not that's not deviant. It's not a sexually maladaptive behavior. It's an opportunity for parents to teach boundaries.
Yeah.
Certainly, we want to teach boundaries in those opportunities, but it's not outside of what we would consider typical curiosity or age-appropriate behavior. Just like when a three-year-old tries to dart out into the street, that's normal for a three-year-old to do that, right? But we have to teach them, nope, I have to hold your hand when we cross the street. It's just a chance for teaching. But these other things, these other times when it is really sexually maladaptive behavior, you'll see some of these behaviors with like a much younger child.
Yeah.
If there's a year or two age difference, that's cause for alarm.
Okay.
If the child has a big emotional response to whatever this behavior was or being caught with the behavior, that can be cause for alarm.
Okay.
You know, and it's not something that parents need to be immediately hysterical about. You know, if parents have a big fear response, if parents become really dysregulated, that's going to shut down their child.
Mm.
And that's not going to help the situation.
No,
the child's going to feel shame, and the child's going to feel like they have to then keep those behaviors secret.
That's, you bring up such a good point with, and again, there's this sense, and I know for a lot of our viewers that hold to a Christian faith, oftentimes I think they are trying to protect their family and their children by just kind of avoiding conversation about that and just like, oh, we don't talk about that. But it seems like there's an important piece of really like having those conversations and passing on the knowledge and values that, as far as with the children, exploring to understand what it is that they're interested in, what their questions are, and then guiding them in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Because most of the time it's just an opportunity for guidance and boundaries.
Yeah.
And you can deepen your relationship with your child, and a child with a secure attachment is far less likely to have issues with sexually maladaptive behaviors. They have their safe place.
Yeah.
They have their parents that they have the secure attachments with. They're less likely to engage in some of these, especially in the aggressive behaviors, but they're less likely to engage in any of them. If they have curiosity, they'll go to the parent and say, I have a question.
Yeah.
And parents will answer.
Yes.
They are just protected. They have a sense that they are valuable, that they're valued, and that they're worthy of protection. And then if something happens where another child is touching them or an adult is touching them, they're going to tell their parents.
Because there's this comfort level and trust, like, hey, you're big enough and strong enough to handle whatever scary thing that I have. And so, so it's so interesting how important it seems like attachment is, I would imagine, as like a protective factor for this, because it really is just about guidance in this way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And for kids who have that secure attachment, they tend to have positive peer relationships as well.
Interesting.
And a lot of the kids with sexually reactive behaviors, and sometimes even with sexually aggressive behaviors, when they're acting out with another child, or they, you know, reach and touch another child or harm another child, even, it's not that they mean to harm the child, the other, you know, their peer.
Yeah.
They want to connect with their peer.
Yeah.
They want to have a connection.
That's good.
They want to have a social interaction, and they don't know how.
Mm.
But when you have a child who has that secure attachment at home with their family, with their parents, they have a better understanding of how to have healthy peer relationships as well.
It's interesting, right? And I know, so for those of you watching, we have a course online, actually two courses that are either out or about to be out. And one is for parents. And so if you're a parent and you're trying to navigate supporting your child through this, we have a great course on familycarelearning.com that's below. And that I think is super supportive, where we dive more deeply into all of this.
Absolutely.
But then we also have one for professionals. Mm-hmm. So if you're a professional therapist or a counselor, and you are just wanting to learn a little bit more about supporting child clients that have that are struggling with some sexually maladaptive behavior, I think this is a great course to start with that. In your training for the professionals, you mentioned something that I just thought was really powerful, and it was something along the lines of like, sexually maladaptive behavior flourishes in shame.
Yes.
And so can you talk a little bit about that? How does shame influence sexually maladaptive behavior?
Absolutely. So when children are experiencing sexually maladaptive behaviors, generally they know it's wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, they know it's wrong. I've yet to meet a child who doesn't know it's wrong.
Right.
And they already feel shame about it. They already feel that they are bad inside. Mm. And shame, I think, even just looking at the difference between shame and guilt.
Okay.
You know, guilt is feeling bad about the thing that you did.
Okay.
Yes. Shame is feeling bad about who you are.
Mm.
And so when you have a child who feels bad about who they are, not just about what they've done, but who they are, they, number one, are more likely to continue those behaviors because why bother trying? I'm already bad.
Yeah.
It kills their hope for a better life or for better behavior or for better connections with other kids or with parents or adults or with anyone. Why bother trying? I can never connect with them. I can't ever have regular connections anyway.
Yeah.
I'm horrible and bad. It also has the effect of driving these behaviors underground.
Yes.
They become more and more secretive with these behaviors, which is the opposite of what you want. If we're trying to treat these behaviors and stop these behaviors, we need that child to be open and honest and feel safe enough to be open and honest with their caregivers, with their therapists or doctors, whoever is treating them. And so it's so important that they don't feel all of that shame.
Yeah.
That parents really have an amazing role in this. They can really take away the levels of shame, and they can tell their children, you know, I love you. I know you've done this thing.
Yeah.
But I love you. Mm. This thing doesn't define who you are, and it doesn't change my feelings for you because I love you and you're my child, no matter what.
Oh, that is so powerful.
Yeah.
And you can see how, right, like you mentioned before about like this worthiness of love or right, like that. And it's that shame is going, I'm not worthy of this. So you're not going to give it to me. Yep. So I got to make myself feel good some way.
I got to take it.
I got it. Right. Like, and so I could see how that could make sexually maladaptive behavior go, man, I'm going to do this physical sexual act instead of having a deep, intimate relationship that is meeting very similar needs, but this one is so healthy and wholesome. Yeah. And this one is, again, it just seems like it's shame based and can really just feel like, man, you're trapped in this.
Yes,
and then people find out, oh no, they're going to think worse of me, which is then like just anxiety producing and kind of like you said, just kind of locks
it even further separates them from people.
Yes.
With healthy connections, they get even further separated.
And so I see how important, as you mentioned, as far as like secure attachment relationships are, because it seems like the symptom is through shame, this distancing, and then your needs are not being met. But if your needs are being met, it's such a powerful insulator.
Oh, and so, absolutely. Mm. And healing.
Healing.
Yeah. And I think that's important to remember too, is that we have these kids who have these behaviors, and the number one thing that parents are afraid of course, is well, first they're afraid of what's going to happen to my child?
Right.
What are my friends and family members in my community, my church? How is this going to change our life? But it always comes around to, and so what happens later down the road? What is my child going to become a rapist?
Yes.
Is my child a sociopath?
Yeah.
I don't even think they feel remorse for this. Mm. You know, that's some of the thoughts and the fears that run around parents' heads. And I think it's really important to remember that those are not foregone conclusions.
Mm, that's so important.
That sexually reactive behavior in childhood and adolescence is treatable. Mm. And point A doesn't equal a horrible, scary criminal point B.
Yes.
It really, really doesn't. And I think that's important to remember that with help, and there is help out there, there's treatment, there's help, the vast majority of children and adolescents do not go on to reoffend as adults.
Mm.
They just don't.
That is so helpful because I think, right, like as a parent, I could imagine if that if my child was struggling with something, like, I would be terrified.
Yes.
And it would be so easy to go to that thought and, like, catastrophizing in that way.
Oh, yeah.
Which then completely sabotages attachment.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
So,
yeah.
And Jenny, I...
Disconnect again.
Yeah. It's such an important topic. Yeah. And I thank you for having the courage and just leading both this parent training and the professional training. And so for those of you watching, if this is interesting to you, if this is something that you feel like you would like more information, again, check out the links below for our family care learning trainings to give you just a little bit more equipping to support your child, your family as they navigate this. Jenny, again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.